Hi, Ken here. In nearly all of our podcasts, you hear students asking questions and their interaction with me. Many listeners find these exchanges illuminating because what is being asked is often exactly what is on their minds. If you find these conversations helpful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate so we can maintain and expand our website. Thanks.
Unfettered Mind. Mind Training, Santa Fe Retreat, Part 5.
Warm up. How many of you had a chance to read the footnote on Torma? I read it this morning. It's not bad. Yes, please. The reason for these changes, or the reasons, to be more accurate, one is that the quality of practice that all of you are contributing to is very strong, so your reward is we take it up a notch. You like that? No, but we'd have to do other things. But it's very clear that all of you are capable of doing this. I try to find a balance between a clear and form and structure, and the very human need to be able to relax, let things dissipate, let things absorb, so forth. One of my concerns is that given the volume of material which we're working with these 10 days, when you're ingesting a lot, it churns up a lot inside. And trying to hold a very strict structure when there's a lot churning inside creates a bit of a pressure cooker sometimes, not always with beneficial effects. But the sense that I have of how everyone is practicing, coming from the interviews as much as from the quality of attention here in the meditation hall, is that you're doing fine. So we can go a bit further. The advantage of observing silence is that it provides a framework for us to deal with what is coming up inside, experiencing it, because in ordinary life, when we're not in silence, something comes inside, we just spill it out, and we get into all of those hairy interactions that we were experimenting with yesterday afternoon. And again, my sense is that the quality of ability, or the ability here in all of you, is such that more opportunity and to work with being just with the reactive tendencies as they arise, using the tools of taking and sending, ultimate bodhicitta, and so forth, this will help deepen and strengthen your practice. In the periods, in the period we have from the end of lunch to the beginning of walking meditation, some of you may choose to be in silence, and if to remain in silence, and that is fine. And if you choose, then I would ask everybody else to respect that. If you do choose to talk and exchange thoughts and reflections and experience, and this is a very good thing, because one of the ways that in the West that we do learn is through exchanging experience. And, you know, this is what I experienced, and that's what I experienced, and different points of view. This is a way that we really learn here in the West. And but I would really recommend that you practice speaking in attention. Now, the simplest way and also the most effective way that I have found to speak in attention is to listen to the sound of my voice as I am speaking, as if I were listening to another person. And you actually hear how you sound to a much greater extent. And there's a feedback mechanism that happens immediately when you do this. And as some of you have heard me relate before, I gave this instruction to a group that I had in Newport Beach many years ago. And the first time I gave the instruction, nobody in the group did it. So I was a little firmer at our next meeting. And subsequent to that, one woman came in. I said, "How'd you do with this instruction?" And she just said, "She never shuts up." She had heard herself for the first time. And this is what you will find. You will hear when you speak in your mother's voice, or in your father's voice, or in somebody else's voice. You will just hear it if you're paying attention to the sound of your voice as you are speaking. You will also hear when what you say is different from what you intended. You'll hear it right in the moment. You will hear when the tone or the inflection is different from what you're feeling. It'll all be right there. And it's a very powerful way to bring presence into the act of speaking. So I would encourage you to do this all the time, really, but particularly during this retreat, because you have the support of everyone here in engaging this effort. Walking meditation, every space is different. What we're going to try here, we'll meet here at 3:30, and walking meditation is walking in attention, just the same as resting with the breath is breathing in attention. You can walk. There are two ways that you can do this. One is the natural walking meditation, in which you just walk at a normal pace. We're going to ask everybody to walk clockwise around the room. You can walk at your own pace, but we're all going to walk in the same direction, which will reduce the likelihood of collisions and other things like that. And so you just walk quite naturally with the attention in the walking. And the first recommendation I would give you is rather than trying to do heel, toe, just feel your foot rolling over the floor as you walk. Because when you walk, your foot hits and then the whole sole makes contact and then you come up on your toe. So you feel the sensation of the foot making contact with the floor. And just do that as a first start in walking meditation. I will be here with you doing that, and I will go around, speak to people individually about ways to bring more attention into the walking. What's always fun is this, most times we start off and it looks like night of the living dead. So, but after a couple of days, one works. The second, and this is for those of you who wish to experiment with this, is walking, taking, and sending meditation. Now, this combines a number of techniques. The key principle is one breath, one step. So that as you step forward with your left foot, for instance, you breathe and you take that one step as you breathe in. And then as you breathe out, you step forward with the right. So you're walking much more slowly in this practice. And of course, you're doing taking and sending as you breathe in and out. And it's synchronized with your walking. Breathe naturally, so that you are synchronizing the walking with the breathing, not breathing with the walking, because you want to maintain a natural breath. Now, this is quite a bit more intense than the natural walking meditation, so you can do either of these as you wish. I suggest that if you're going to do both in a given session of meditation, start off with the taking and sending, and when you feel that it's there enough, then you can relax and do natural walking for the latter part of it. Okay. Yes. No, it means one in breath with one foot and the out breath with the other. If you slow it down to an in and out breath on one step, then you're in a whole other ball game. We're not going there today. Yes, Peter. Synchronize the walking with the breathing so the breathing remains natural. Okay. So you may find yourself taking relatively short steps. And if you're doing the one breath, one step meditation, please pay attention that you still walk completely naturally. It's just the whole thing is slowed down. And so you're going to end up balancing on one foot for a period of time, not going junk, junk, junk. And I'll demonstrate this when we do it this afternoon. Okay? All right. Yesterday, we talked about two of the special methods for bringing practice to bear in adverse situations. And this morning, we'll look briefly at the other two, giving torma to gods and demons and offering torma to dakinis and protectors. Now, Tibetan Buddhism, by and large, places a very heavy emphasis on ritual. And you had rituals and ceremonies for almost everything. And any time anything went wrong in your life, for that matter, any time anything went right in your life, you did a little ritual. And so these torma offerings are rituals in which you prepare a bunch of stuff and you recite a liturgy and you do a visualization, make an offering. What is being acted out in the ritual is, in the case of giving torma to gods and demons, you are nourishing, not nourishing so much as giving your attention to those things that hook us into reactive behaviors. Gods and demons are symbols, essentially, for those aspects or those things that arise in our experience which feel good to us. Those are the gods. And those things that feel bad to us, those are the demons. And ordinarily, when something feels good, we just feel good and we attach to it and we want more and we're attracted to it and so forth. And when something unpleasant happens, then we want to push it away, get rid of it, kill the messenger, and so forth. By doing these little rituals, what you're in effect doing is acknowledging, oh, that happened, and oh, that happened. So you're just noting it. And disengaging from the ensuing, or the habituation which would cause us to make a big deal one way or the other out of it. And that's the essential idea here. Now, I've thought about this for many years, and I'm still at a loss, is how to translate that ritual-based practice into the way we live life here in the West. So if any of you have any ideas about that, I'm very open to them. And then the offering torma to dakinis and protectors. Dakinis and protectors are symbols of awakened, the activity of awakened mind. What does this phrase, the activity of awakened mind, mean? It means when we do something naturally from just knowing what to do without any preconception. And we do this all the time, actually. We just don't notice it. The story of Ananda's enlightenment is relevant here. Ananda was excluded from the conference following Buddha's death, in the conference of the senior students who are all arhats, all a degree of enlightenment, who were going to decide what was going to be preserved as the Buddha's teaching. And it was very unfortunate that Ananda was excluded from this, because he'd been at all of the Buddha's teachings throughout the whole life of Buddha Shakyamuni, and he had a phonographic memory, so he had it all. And the story is told that, this is the Zen version of the story, the Theravadan story is a little bit different, that Mahakasyapa, who was one of the top arhats, said, no, you can't come in because you're not enlightened. And Ananda turned away very sadly, and Mahakasyapa said, Ananda! And without any thought whatsoever, Ananda just turned around and said, yes. And those kinds of simple responses where we're just right there, that is what the dakinis and protectors are symbolizing. In other situations where somebody, you walk into a situation and you see what needs to happen without any thought, you just do it. That is the manifestation of the awakened mind. There's no sense of, I am going to do this for this person. It's something that just happens like that. And so what you're doing here, again in one of these little rituals, is nourishing that quality in your own experience. So in both of these, in essence, the offering of torma is an offering of attention to, on the one hand, those aspects of experience which pull us into reactive patterns, and on the other hand, those aspects of our experience and activity which are an expression of being awake. Okay? Now the... Just let me check there. That's right. And then we have... Now, someone pointed out to me many years later that the quotation on top of page 23, in order to take unexpected conditions as the path, wasn't actually part of the root text. Sometimes very difficult to tell in the Tibetan what's part of the root text and what isn't. So you'll see in the revised translation in here, page 37, just the last line is translated, whatever you encounter, work with it immediately. Now, they have a book here in which visiting teachers who come are invited to write something, and I was leafing through it yesterday and saw what Stephen Batchelor had written. Practice as if your hair was on fire. Now, what do you do if your hair's on fire? Do you waste any time? No. You're right there. Okay. That's the idea here. Train yourself. Train so that as soon as something arises in your experience, it's a trigger for attention and you're right there. Don't wait and say, oh, well, I'm feeling a little angry. I'll work on that tomorrow. Or I'll do that later. In the way that we're practicing here with taking and sending, as soon as you feel any anger, use taking and sending to experience it completely. As soon as you feel any desire or attraction or longing, loneliness or pride or any of this stuff, right there. As soon as you feel any joy, contentment, peace, right there, train with it. Is it what's positive and fulfilling and pleasant? Give it away. What's unpleasant, disturbing, anxiety-provoking, fear-instilling? Open to it. Experience it completely. Don't waste any time. So this is one of the reasons why the earlier instruction was use maxims to train. And so the two that I've used most of the time are the first one from Longri Tongpa's 8 Verses of Mind Training. Give all victory, give all gain and victory to others, take all loss and defeat for yourself. And another one, which is general mind training teaching, is may all virtue ripen for them, may all unwholesome activity ripen for me. No, real downer. May all virtue ripen for them, all goodness and virtue ripen for them, may all adversity and unwholesomeness ripen for me. Them being all sentient beings. When I was reading Uchiyama's Refining Your Life, which I think is just a great book, he has this wonderful phrase, gain is illusion, loss is enlightenment. Now, this is a little different take on it, but it's in the same vein. And I discussed the connection between the two in Wake Up to Your Life. But that's another one you can use. You know. Anytime you think you're getting somewhere, you're going deeper into illusion. When you think it's just hopeless and everything's falling apart in your life, you know, you're moving closer to the source of being. Gain is illusion, loss is enlightenment. Such a cheery teaching. You know. That one I've also found very useful. Particularly when, you know, things just go completely, just blow up and everything is just a mess, you know, and you're sitting and thinking, like, what the hell happened? And nothing you've wanted, you're trying to do or trying to make happen, it's all just fallen apart, you know, and you've lost everything. And you're just like, oh. And when you've lost everything, you're returning to what you actually are. It really works. Okay. You find other phrases in the text here. May all sentient beings come to engage naturally in much greater activity than this. And may every evil thought and action of every sentient being be gathered in mind. Taking on quite a load. Okay. Now, the next section, the utilization of practice in one's life. This is a typical device that is used in many Tibetan texts, and I think in the original Indian as well. And that was to come up with something that was easy to remember so that you could, which would guide you in the right direction in every situation. And so here the list that's easy to remember are what are called the five forces. And they are the force, the way I translated them earlier was the force of impetus, the force of familiarization, the force of virtuous seeds, the force of repudiation, and the force of aspiration. I would change the first two, and I might change the other ones later, just to confuse you. The force of impetus really means intention. And you will see in the text, it's the same as that I gave you for your wake-up practice. From this moment until I awaken, at least from now until I die, indefinitely from this year, this month, and especially from today until tomorrow, at least for the next 2 minutes, I will keep the two aspects of awakening mind in me all the time. This is setting intention. And setting intention is very important. Every practice has an intention. Each of you in your own practice has an intention. Now, when we first started, this practice, this retreat, I asked, why are you here and what do you want to get from this retreat? And the purpose of those questions were to help you get in touch with your intention for this retreat. One of the things that happens all too often is that people accept the intention and accept the practices that they're given without questioning whether they really fit with their own intention in practice. So you need to be clear about what the intention of a practice is, and is it in line with what you are practicing for? And everybody can say, oh yeah, I'm practicing to get enlightened for the welfare of all sentient beings, but that's something that we're given initially. And yes, through the course of practice, we may discover that intention in ourselves, and then our practice takes on a whole different quality. But I want to emphasize the importance about being clear about your intention and about doing practice, which is approaching practice in a way which is aligned with that intention. Then you'll be able to pour your energy into the practice and it will be fruitful. If there is a discrepancy or a divergence between the intention of the practice and what you want to do, it's not going to be as fruitful. This also applies to teaching. A colleague of mine I invited to attend a retreat, Mount Baldy, many years ago. And on our way up, we stopped for lunch. And he's totally, very deeply steeped in the Tibetan tradition, was a monk for 20 years, almost got his geshe qualifications, very, very knowledgeable, and a very kind and person. And over lunch I said, what do you want to teach? And he said, oh, to benefit all sentient beings. I said, yeah, I know, that's the Buddha's propaganda. Why do you want to teach? And he thought for a little bit. He said, I can't think of anything else to say, Ken. That's all that comes to mind. And I felt very sad at that point, because having hung around with them and we worked together at a conference on some stuff, I know why he teaches. And he teaches because he loves the Dharma. And you can feel it in the way that he talks about it and expresses it. It's just pure love for the Dharma. But he's not in touch with his own intention. He's absorbed the system's intention. And so there's always that discrepancy there. And it shows up in the way that his life manifests. So I really want you to be clear about your intention is. That's where the power of your practice comes from. It's acting on your intention. And as practice matures, what we discover is all of the stuff that's written in here and all the other things, I mean, it really unfolds, and it becomes our intention. But it becomes our intention not because we've adopted it and tried to train ourselves in it, but because we followed our intention, and as we go deeper and deeper into our own experience, this is what we discover, because this is what we are. We are emptiness and compassion. So there's no other thing to manifest. But it's something we discover from inside, not something that we take on like a coat or a uniform or anything like that. So, that's the first. The second is the force of familiarization. And basically this means you just keep doing it over and over and over again until it's just part of you. And that's very much the purpose of this retreat. Just going to do it, you know, every breath. In with the bad air, out with the good air. In with the bad. Basically what it boils down to, isn't it? You know, and as we do this again and again and again, it just becomes the way we approach experience. It's training, it's familiarization, it's habituation, whatever you want to call it. But the idea is to train deeply so it's just there. The third is virtuous seeds. The actual Tibetan is white seeds, but that seemed a little obscure in English, so I changed it to virtuous. And this means that we just do good. And doing good, whenever the opportunity arises, in the way that we discussed the other day, creates a clarity and opening in the mind so that we're just a little bit more there. The fourth is the force of repudiation. And whereas the force of virtuous seeds is addressing wholesome actions, force of repudiation is addressing unwholesome actions. Now, unwholesome actions are those actions which close the mind down. One of the exercises that sometimes do give people, we don't take this too far, but I may ask someone to lie intentionally, to pick a situation and intentionally deceive another person. It just a totally conscious act, to observe what happens in you when you do this. And at least my experience to date is you cannot lie to someone without something shutting down in you. You have to close off something in order to do it. Regard the person as an object. You cannot lie in presence. There's a shutting down. And that's the key principle of unwholesome action, is that it shuts something down inside so we are less present. And it's interesting, I came across a definition of sin in the Christian tradition is that which separates you from God. And it's exactly the same idea. So, whenever we do something which shuts down, and most common example of that is doing things which are harmful to others, then we are doing something that is contrary to our intention. And so we repudiate the action, which means that we acknowledge that we did it, and we say, no, I'm not going to go there anymore. And then the fifth force is the force of aspiration, right? And this sounds like not very much, and for many years I dismissed it as a really viable thing, but as I read more and studied more and practiced more, I came to understand this is really important. Kala Rinpoche would often say, you know, do this, but if you can't do this, then pray to be able to do this. And I would say, oh, okay, well, that's the consolation prize. But the wisdom in that is that by forming that aspiration, you're beginning to form an intention. And by aspiring to do that, you're actually preparing the ground so that one day you're able to do it. So in the Tibetan tradition, you have these prayers of aspiration which are absolutely mind-boggling in scope. Yeah. It's said that the Jamgon Kontrol, who was a great teacher in the 19th century, is destined to be the 1,000th Buddha of this aeon of 1,000 Buddhas. These are vast reaches of time we're talking about. And his aspiration for bodhicitta is to do as much when he is a Buddha as all the 999 Buddhas before him. That's like a big aspiration. And but there's when you think in these terms, what happens to your mind? You know, you just open, right? And that's part of the purpose. There's nothing which really limits here. And so if you read the Avatamsaka Sutra, I mean, the scale of which things are done, just, you know, in every atom in the universe, there are Buddha fields as numerous as there are atoms in the universe. It's like, what? So here we have Kontrol's, may I on my own, notice that, big aspiration, guide all sentient beings to Buddhahood, in particularly from now until I attain enlightenment, may I never forget the two aspects of bodhicitta, even when I'm dreaming. May the two aspects of bodhicitta grow stronger and stronger. Whatever adverse conditions I encounter, may I take them as aids to bodhicitta. We also have in the Zen tradition the four vows, sentient beings are limitless, I vow to save them all. Dharma doors are innumerable, I vow to enter them all. Reactive emotions are infinite, I vow to resolve them all. The way is limitless, I can't remember the fourth one, what is it? I got to make some. Pardon? Yeah. But it's a similarly huge, I think they're written out here somewhere, saw them, yeah. And there are many different versions of them, but they all have the same four themes. But again, it's vast and huge. So I guess this could be boiled down to two words: think big. Now, what to do at death? There are two aspects to life. There's living and there's dying. Most of us aren't too conscious when we're being born, so we get living and dying. And the next section in here applies the five forces to the dying process. Give everything away before you die. That's seeds of virtuous action, that force. Come to terms with all the harm that you've caused in your life. I'm always, I've found T.S. Eliot's lines, the gifts reserved for old age, the shame of things ill done and done to others harm, which once you took for exercise of virtue. Yeah. Because these are the things that are going to come back to haunt us when we die, or as we are dying. And so, very important to come to terms with those before. And that's what the force of repudiation is about. Force of impetus, intention, is to carry that intention right into death. Intention to be awake and present, to be in, to be emptiness and compassion right into death. And then the force of familiarization is to keep training right until you die. Now the paragraph on page 26 is the actual instructions. And what I want you to do for the rest of the retreat is to practice this when you go to sleep at night. And if you're taking a nap in the day, practice it then too. So you're approaching going to sleep as if you were dying. And you go through these five, these various forces, like, okay, what did I do? It wasn't so good today. And what aspiration am I making? And then you lie down. Now, the traditional instruction is you lie down on your right side, putting your cheek, your right hand here, and using the little finger to block the nostril. The idea here is that in tantric physiology, the right channel is the channel of reactive emotions, the left channel is the channel of pristine wisdom. But again, this should be reversed for women. But it gets a little tricky here, because the other reason for lying down is that your heart's more on the left side. So when you lie down on this side, you aren't crushing the heart and reducing its ability. So this I'm not sure you should be switching or not. It's all very confused, and I've never found any lama who can straighten it out for me. But Buddha died lying on his right side like this. And you just practice taking and sending as you go to sleep. Breathing in suffering of others, breathing out your own, everything that you value and cherish and enjoy. And as your mind becomes quiet, then you just rest in open awareness. And if you can go to sleep that way, and if you can die that way, very good. My ex-wife asked Boka Rinpoche, who's Kala Rinpoche's successor, during the three-year retreat, because we were given about 15 different instructions for what to do when you die. And you have, you know, poa and things like that. And Boka Rinpoche said, this is the most important one, this one. Forget about all the other stuff. Do this one. Specifically the taking, sending, the one right here. Page 26. Yeah, in the Great Path. Pardon? Well, the main point is to practice these forces single-mindedly, the accompanying actions are also important. Physically, one should sit in the seven-pointed posture, or if unable to do that, etc. That one. Now, if you can die sitting up, it's meant to be better. But it's not essential, because Buddha didn't die. He wasn't sitting up when he died. Now, you have this odd paragraph at the top of page 27. And, you know, what is this? An instruction for death that employs the solved states. Applied to the crown of the head, an ointment compounded of wild honey, ash from burning unspoiled seashells, and filings from an iron magnet. Okay? Well, unspoiled means they weren't broken. They're perfect in form. Now, no, they're seashells. Now, what's going on here? Well, this is known as the Brahmanical aperture, right at the top of the head. I think it's the fontanelle. That's the name in English. And when you're doing Hola...
You have just heard a talk by Ken MacLeod, author of Wake Up to Your Life and director of Unfettered Mind, a California nonprofit corporation. This podcast and many others can be found on both iTunes and on the Unfettered Mind website at www.unfetteredmind.org. This podcast is free and has been made available through generous donations from our listeners. We would appreciate any assistance you can offer. Your tax-deductible donations may be made through the Unfettered Mind website, unfetteredmind.org, where you will find translations, articles, information about Buddhism, and other programs given by Ken MacLeod. All rights in this podcast, given by Ken MacLeod, are owned by Unfettered Mind. Unfettered Mind hereby grants you, the listener, the non-exclusive license to listen to and distribute this podcast freely, but only without charge and only if each copy contains all the original contents and these proprietary notices. You may not charge any fee of any kind for making a copy of this podcast available in any form. You may not extract portions of this podcast except for commentary purposes and only if you give proper attribution and this proprietary notice. You may not include this podcast, or any portion thereof, with any other podcasts, talks, information, or data for which any amount is charged. Title, ownership rights, and intellectual property rights in and to this podcast shall remain in Unfettered Mind. This podcast and all elements within it are protected by the copyright laws of the United States and international copyright treaties.
Unfettered Mind retains all rights to these podcasts. If you wish to use part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.